Hello, everyone. So as Rose said, my name is Natalie, and I'm here to present on a research study that we, a group of us at the School of Public Health at University of Michigan did, looking at municipal heatwave planning in four U.S. cities, and particularly with an eye on vulnerable populations. And we have a list of co-presenters. I'm fortunate enough to be in a team of eight, and Edith Parker, who's here today, Sabrina McCormick, Jalon White Newsom, Karina Grunland, Linda Catalano, Mietta Buxton, and Marie O'Neill, who's our PI on the project. I have no relationships or conflicts of interest to disclose. I also want to acknowledge that this was funded by the CDC, and it comes out of a larger research program, a multi-institutional research program, asking research questions related to heat morbidity, heat warning systems, and risk communication that's led by a team of investigators and experts. Thank you. Whoops, wrong way. So, quickly, what I'm going to try to accomplish today is briefly go over what climate change has to do with heat and what that has to do with health and what that has to do with social disparities for those of us who aren't climatologists like myself, who's not a climatologist. And then I'm going to discuss the four-city case study and look at some of our findings specific to the program interventions that cities are planning. So, extremely briefly, we know that heat mortality is an issue in the United States. Between 400 to 600 people die each year. While this doesn't sound like a high rate of mortality for a health issue, we know that there are specific instances where we see much higher rates of in the thousands. Sometimes in Europe, we saw 30,000 in the early 2000s. So we know this is an issue. We also know that heat-related morbidity, which is hard to grasp and hard to measure, is an issue. We see fatigue, dizziness, weakness, people with already chronic illnesses existing are compounded by the effects of heat. Finally, we know that climate change is projected to increase. So those of you who have heard of the IPCC studies, one of the most robust peer-reviewed literatures on climate change projects several different scenarios, and we know that chances are there's going to be an increase in heat waves, and so we need to be thinking about vulnerable populations. Vulnerability can be considered in a few different ways. And so, like most public health issues, we know that the elderly, the young, those with chronic illness are more at risk for these types of health outcomes. And we can look at this biomedically, knowing that people have variability in how they react to heat and how they metabolize in response to heat. We can look at this from a socioeconomic perspective. So, do people have access to transportation to get to a cooling center? Do people have access to air conditioners? If any of you have read Kleinenberg's book, Heatwave, you know a lot about this. And then we can look at this from a land use geographic perspective, which some of my expert colleagues today will talk about. So certain urban areas are prone by land use to have higher temperatures. And what does that mean locally? So what we decided to do was a four-city case study. And as you can see here, we worked with Detroit, Philadelphia, New York, and Phoenix. And we were looking to understand and describe adoption of heat wave mitigation and adaptation interventions in the U.S. So mitigation being, how can we stop what's already happening from climate change? And adaptation being, how can we adjust and adapt to what's going on, considering that it's happening quite fast these days? And so in 2004, in the American Journal of Public Health, there was an article by Murdarn and McGeenan who looked at heat wave response programs and plans throughout the United States and did a review of the literature, finding that those cities that did have heat wave response plans, they were quite cursory. There were very few that laid out what heat health warning systems looked like, what programs should look like. But at the same time, most of us knew that cities wanted to be working on this issue, and we knew that cities were doing things to address this issue, but we just didn't know what. So hence this study. We chose qualitative methods because we really wanted to grasp some of the context of what was going on in each location. We wanted to be able to understand and distill what were the relationships, what were the processes that decide what kinds of programs or what kinds of interventions are adopted. And the reason we picked these four cities was because they're quite diverse, climate-wise, demographically, politically. We also had stakeholders at these locations that we knew we could work with to interview and talk with and try to understand what was going on. They also had various levels of implementation. So some cities had elaborate heat wave task force that had elaborate heat health warning systems that helped us to determine whether or not we should initiate programs, while other cities were kind of just starting these conversations and putting it on the agenda. So we decided to conduct a document review, which came out of our interviews. So when we went to talk to people, we asked them if there were any documents they could share with us related to their heat health programming. And we also conducted semi-structured interviews, and we conducted quite a few. 120 so far have been done throughout the four cities. We, in each city, aim to talk with about 20 people who are of the target population, community members, and we aim to speak with about 20 to 25 government and community leaders who are making some of these decisions about the interventions. And so we selected leaders based on snowball sampling. We identified people we knew were working on heat waves, and then at the end of each interview asked them to identify additional people. In this way, we felt like we could cover a broad range of people doing different things related to adaptation and mitigation. Excuse me. For community members, we use GIS mapping, geographic information systems, to identify vulnerable populations based on each city, so where were senior citizens living. Also, we wanted a diverse group, so where were different demographically, where were people living. And we also worked with government and community leaders to identify those who were homeless or struggling with home security so that we could also identify that target population. So we asked a host of questions with different interview protocols for each group. Community members, we tried to get at their attitudes, their behavior, their knowledge, suggestions they had for heat wave programming, also what they did or didn't like about heat wave programming that exists, if they knew about any that existed. For government and community leaders, it was more of a program policy approach. We wanted to know what programs they knew of, what they were involved in, what partnerships existed, the history of these programs, if they had been evaluated, the cost, and so forth. So these are just a few sample questions that we asked. We used pretty typical, traditional, qualitative analysis methods. Our team of eight was great. We came together over 8 months and continuously developed themes or codes that we found in the transcripts of the interviews, and we used in vivo software to do this. And we found many new themes emerging in vivo, so from the words of the interviewers themselves, as well as some based on our own research questions. So some of the themes were heatwave experiences that people had, neighborhood and community characteristics, historical or geographic comparisons. So interviewers would talk about what happened in Chicago or what they think is happening in Texas or make these comparisons as to what they should be doing in their city. Factors related to vulnerability. So what does one define as a vulnerable population? And do, if you're a community member, do you define yourself as a vulnerable population or at risk? And then again, some of these research questions we asked about program description. We were looking for these themes. And then finally, what activates these programs? What are cities doing to activate when they decide they're going to have a cooling center open, for instance? We're in the process of the document review currently, but I want to touch upon the diversity of documents we've received from the agencies and the organizations that we spoke with. We've collected heat emergency plans and policies, educational brochures, things that you would see on heat planning websites, utility assistance brochures. So companies have worked with individuals who are maybe not able to pay their bills throughout the year, so figuring out if you have air conditioning, if you have heat, how do we pay this? Weatherization brochures, so how to make your home friendly to multiple climates or changes in climate. And so thinking about these different documents, we realize one of the limitations is that we can't capture everything. We can't also capture what's internal. What we're seeing is we're not hearing a lot of a concerted effort across these plans and programs. We're not seeing evaluation documents. But again, we're still in the process of going through these. So this slide is a bit overwhelming, and it's packed with sort of everything we found people were doing. And I just want to point out some of the themes in the spectrum of programs and policies that were going on in these different cities. One you'll notice is that when asked, community leaders and government leaders mentioned many more adaptation strategies, excuse me, than mitigation strategies. So you'll see white roofs that are going on in Philadelphia, and misters, which are sort of just misting water at bus stops, are forms of infrastructure that's happening. But a lot of these are programs and planning that have just already been happening at the level of aging agencies, public health departments, emergency response. So a lot of them aren't considered necessarily heat specific, but when you ask someone, what are you doing about heat planning, these are some of the things they talk about. And some are ones that you'd guess as well, so cooling centers, air conditioning distribution, food and water distribution. But then we also have some innovative solutions, so working with carriers, maybe postal workers, apartment managers, or doormen, or utility people, who come to these homes regularly of vulnerable populations to see if they're doing okay. And so these programs do exist currently. Some of them have an eye to heat planning and some of them don't, but maybe an opportunity for that. So there's multiple heat health warning systems that activate this programming. Many of you may have heard of heat health warning systems by the NOAA and the National Weather Service. This is a model that's created, and some of my colleagues might talk about it, that takes into context some of that local land use, air mass, what's going on locally, and setting up a model specific to a location. Some of the cities we talked to used heat health warning systems. Some referred to the old heat index that basically looks at humidity and temperature. And then there was a wide range of approaches otherwise. So these were just two quotes from community members, both in Philadelphia, kind of capturing the importance of thinking about how we activate these programs both internally and how we activate them externally into the news and into the media. So one community member says, if the temperature is really soaring, and then the news helps a lot, telling you senior citizens stay in, do this, do that, so I go along with the flow. While as another community member goes on to say that she's quite burned out by this messaging, so she says at the end, I guess it makes me think, oh, another day of this where if they don't keep blasting away, I would just do what I have to do, but it's constantly in your face. So thinking about how we activate these programs is important. So now I'm just going to go quickly over, I'm summarizing for all four cities today, quickly over some of the barriers that we saw and some of the catalysts we saw to the programming that's going on currently in the cities. Some of these barriers are to creating the programs themselves, and some of these barriers are to getting people to participate in the programs. And as you may have guessed, our first barrier is funding. So a lot of this is happening at local health departments who are strapped for funding and resources, and this came up time and time again. So you have the facilities to open them, cooling centers. It's just that the almighty buck is in the way, was how one community member in Detroit described it. But across the board, this was a common theme. Another concerning barrier is this idea that heat is not a problem in my city. And so this quote sums it up. So we have this problem for 3 months out of the year, and where in some other areas, that might be a constant situation. I know what we do have plans to provide information to folks on locations that they can go. You know what to do in terms of drinking water, staying hydrated. I'm not sure that there's any more that needs to be done. This is a concern because a lot of times we see that mortality happens at a higher rate in cities that have colder climates. And so cities where people think heat's not a problem is where we have less air conditioners, where we have less adaptation going on, and also where we have people who aren't used to that climate. And so it's a concern that we should be considering. Compartmentalization. So this idea that form follows funding is also another concern that came up in several of the interviews. A government employee in Philadelphia explained they put together a program where they offered air conditioners to community members, but one of the problems was that they didn't offer funding to deal with the increased energy usage and bills. So the program was so severely flawed that we were expected to give out these air conditioners without giving people any energy conservation service. So we were adding to their bill as a low-income person. So this is a concern thinking about how as we work interdisciplinary between emergency planning, public health, urban planning, how are we compartmentalizing our funds, where are we getting it from, and what are we overlooking? And then finally, the last barrier I'm going to mention is this idea that I'm not vulnerable. So this more comes out of the community member interviews, but a government employee described it as the stigma that I'm not a senior, so I won't be accepted. You can go to a cooling center. Anybody can go. When it's established heat wave and those cooling centers are open, go. Because if it's a senior center, go to a library. And that's the other thing. So if you feel like you're 35 and you happen to be diabetic, there's no reason you shouldn't be going, is basically what this government employee is saying. So a lot of people talked about how cooling centers were for other people than themselves. And so maybe they had the stereotype of, you know, I have a home, why would I go to a cooling center? I'm young, why would I go to a cooling center? So some of these barriers. Thank you. So quickly, I'll go through some of the catalysts that give us hope and are on the upside of what we found. We know that there's a natural integration, like I mentioned, of heat health strategies into existing services. So a lot of times, community members will go to cooling centers or homeless shelters for reasons other than heat wave programming. And so they don't think about heat necessarily. They might be thinking about activities that exist, programming, social events, transportation to the mall. This is what some of the seniors talked about. And in this discussion at the homeless shelter, they talked about the food and the nutrition resources that were there. Another catalyst, in three of the four cities, we spoke with folks who talked about community campus partnerships. So there were opportunities to work on these complicated, sometimes expensive development of models for heat wave planning that was going on all around. There were also many partnerships to address these funding gaps. So people were thinking creatively and innovatively of how, across the board, NGOs can be working with universities, can be working with the local government to get funding to address some of these problems broadly under the umbrella of climate change, but also focusing on heat. And then finally, in New York, a government employee pointed out something we always try to remember in public health, but sometimes forget to do, is that we should be engaging vulnerable populations. And so sometimes we overlook this and we make programs or plans that don't work out so well. And so she said, we try to change the culture where how we capitalize on that experience rather than patronizing this population. And normally, working with older adults, we find it very helpful when they get involved. Not that they're treated like frail, incapable, or taking care of themselves. And we know from our community member interviews that they had some candid thoughts about what worked and what didn't work, and so taking that into consideration is important. So wrapping it up, I just want to mention some of our emerging recommendations. Obviously, we have a lot more time to spend with this rich data. We have over 120 interviews. We want to work with each city to develop what might work best for them, but also offer this broad feedback as a national framework. Some of the recommendations is to start thinking about socially isolated populations as a concerted effort. So agencies that are focused on aging, agencies focused on food insecurity, groups that are already doing this type of work, partnering with them to understand where these populations where they're living and how we can reach them better. Again, as I mentioned, the frequency and degree of heat events should be considered. So as this is a risk communication issue and heat waves are increasing, is this something we're going to be saying on the news every day, and how are people going to respond behaviorally to that? And then to also acknowledge that there's plenty of things already going on and we don't need to reinvent the wheel. So this is actually a website by the CDC who's kind of a clearinghouse for some of these educational documents and thinking about what are some of these other cities doing. And I think part of this project is to share with Philly what Phoenix is doing, what New York is doing. And then finally, there's very little evaluation of any of this going on. And so to understand what could best practices be, we're not quite there yet. So in future directions, we'll be looking to hold city-specific workshops in every city, starting in Detroit this winter. We're going to share these results and, again, work with them specifically on the findings from their city. We're also going to hold a community resident outreach initiative planned for spring 2011. So as we look forward, I also suggest that we look backwards, and we look back to 1930. This is a page from the American Journal of Public Health. You'll see that heat waves aren't listed as one of the disasters that we thought about. And I want to say that we've always been adapting and working on adaptation, and I think with climate change, it's obviously a little bit more urgent, but that if we can be planned and anticipatory rather than reacting and unplanned, that we can probably address some of these social disparity issues better than if we didn't. So I want to thank you all for your attention today.